You're listening to Conscious Living Radio 100.5 FM in Vancouver, Co-op Radio. I'm Tasha Sims.
And I'm Mark Cron.
Welcome to the show. So, hey, International Women's Day this Friday. Did you know that?
I found that out today. What a great day. I honor all the women and the divine feminine, so it's a great day. Tell us more.
Well, there's going to be a rally, actually, at Robson Square from 5:30 to 7, and they're going to have speakers. It's diverse. It's really, there's quite a bit of activism as well, so they're going to be talking about Syrian refugees, a focus on the missing and murdered Indigenous women, and also residents for community control on city development. So the invitation really is to come out and be a voice, talking about political, social, cultural, economic rights so we can all live in dignity and with respect. It's kind of a cool theme. It's actually called Equal Rights for a Better World.
Nice.
So that's this Friday, Robson Square. It's a free event. There'll be dancing, singing, music, street performers, stuff like that. Should
Fantastic.
Be fun.
And it's a great segue into our show this evening.
It is, because we have this other event that we're talking about tonight called Converge 2019, Converge Con. It's actually an annual conference held in Vancouver that covers topics related to sexuality, health, relationships, and activism. The speakers include educators, clinical counselors, sex workers, panels, other leaders in the field. And the goal is to offer a safe, inclusive space for all people interested in creating a sex-positive future. In the studio this evening, we've got a lot of people, and we have a person calling in as well.
It's the most guests I've ever had on the show. So
there you go. It's a party. You guys get lively here. This could be fun. We've got Wendy Neeson. She's one of the co-producers of this event, and some of the presenters. So Dr. Shauna Rhea and Melody Ann, and calling in from the States, Alex Wilson. So I'm going to introduce everybody before we dive right in. Dr. Shauna Correa, there, that's how you pronounce it, served as clinical faculty at the University of British Columbia. She works as a sexual medicine specialist at BC Centre for Sexual Medicine, where she assesses and treats men, women, and gender diverse individuals and couples referred for a wide variety of sexual difficulties and concerns. She's involved in several research projects around the optimization of sexual functioning and has a strong interest in sexual medical education. Also joining us, Melody Ann, who's an adult sexuality educator. She's a workshop facilitator, also a sex researcher, a feminist, a kinkster, all-round sensual adventurer, and calls herself a shameless sex geek with a degree in psychology and sexuality studies. She juggles her time between coordinating studies at a sex research lab, teaching workshops on kink, sexual health, and pleasure. And her talk at the conference is going to be Pleasure Bound, What You Need to Know About Rope Bondage, and as well, something I want to dive into tonight, Healing Through Kink, BDSM, Trauma and Illness, and it's a talk that she's giving with Alex Wilson, who's calling in all the way from, I believe, D.C., if that's where you are, Alex. She's a D.C.-based sex educator who's been crafting workshops, lectures, and panels for the past 5 years. As a trauma educator, speaker, and harm reductionist, Alex facilitates trainings and direct community outreach, and will be offering some of those at Converge. Their talks at the conference include From Cuckold to Race Play, The Implications of Fetishizing Race, Mind the Gap, Mapping the Implications of Emotion, Logic Binary, and Trauma on the Road to Sexual Liberation. There's so many juicy topics, and pun intended. let's start, though, because we got a lot. This is like four shows to me, at least. Let's start, though, with an overview of the conference and how it came to be. So, Wendy, I'm going to direct it to you. I know that Kale was a founding director of Converge Con, along with you and Diane are at the core of creating this conference. So let me introduce a little bit about you. You're a lifelong ethical non-monogamist, and you aspire to teach, share, and support an open dialogue around sexuality, relationship, and gender. So, give us a history and the intention behind Converge Con.
Well, the history is that Kale and I, went to a conference in the United States called Catalyst Con And we were really inspired by the event there and realized there was nothing really like that in Canada, especially in Vancouver. And there was a need for it. There was a need for these conversations to be having, to be happening, to have them, to provide a space for that. So having never thrown a conference before, we roped in Diane's help, and we started putting it on. And it wasn't easy, but we threw it together. The first conference, I think, when I want to say like 3 months. And
this is the second year.
This is the third year, actually. The second year was it just keeps getting better and better, and we're really excited about this year. Yeah, so it wasn't like a direct replication of Catalyst Con, because a lot of the people that go to Catalyst Con are more educators and professionals, and they actually go there to get accreditation for their continuing education kind of thing. We wanted ConvergeCon to be open to everybody, including those folks, but also to just regular folks on the street who need to learn and have conversations.
So what would a person expect? And where is it going to be? It's at Simon Fraser downtown?
Yeah, it's at the SFU Harbor Center campus, mm-hmm. and we've rented the theater at And it's, both four different rooms, the Bentall Center, it's called. It's our first year actually downtown. We'd thrown the previous two at a hotel, but that's not, we've outgrown the space, let's just say that. And so we're excited to go to an education facility and have a lot of freedom to put on the event.
And basically, are you moving around, or is it you're sitting and people are speaking, or is there an active experiential piece? Kind of paint a picture for people who have no idea what
sure,
to expect.
Sure, it's just like any conference you've ever been to. You go in, you register, and then you look at the schedule. I mean, the schedule is live right now. Get convergecon.ca. And you pick where you want to go, and you do move from room to room. The talks are about 40 minutes long, and there's space in between. This year, actually, we have maybe a little bit of a demo sort of going on, and a more active, interactive space. We have the theater booked in the morning for our keynote speaker, Dr. Carol Queen, who I'm super, super excited to have. And then in the afternoon, we're opening it up to a little bit more BDSM kink-focused folks. And I think Melody Ann's going to be doing, a demo of bondage. And there'll be also another talk about being a top or a dominant, which I think may or may not have some demos as well. So there is a demos and a chance for interaction there. But mostly, yeah, you're just sitting and listening to people and talking and interacting mm-hmm. with questions.
There will be a knot tying activity where people will learn a tie that's the basis for a lot of rope bondage. So that will be somewhat interactive. That is a workshop I'll be teaching with Victor Salmon.
Fun. Okay, so who's it for? Is it really for everybody?
I think it's for everybody. I think it's definitely for people who want to learn more, mm-hmm. who want to talk about things in a safe place. There's a chance for you to go and not talk to anyone and not interact with anyone. Like, we try to make it inclusive for queer folks, for people of color, for people with different abilities, and I've seen people who come and are professors, and they're just their minds get blown. So there've also been people who are my friends who come and they just don't really understand most of the conversations that are happening, but they're just like, I had no idea there was this much to talk about gender. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So mm-hmm. yeah.
So can we shift Melody over to you? I know we're going to be talking about BDSM as a healing modality for trauma, which I find really intriguing. But I want to start with some basic information. There could be listeners right now who are completely new to the whole concept. I mean, they've heard of it, but they really don't understand what it's about. So what's the most important thing you want them to know?
I was going to start by demystifying BDSM because it almost has this, mysterious ring to it because not everyone actually knows what it stands for. It's actually a 3-in-1 acronym that stands for bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, and sadism and masochism. And a lot of people end up skipping over, you know, the D and the S on the way to the S and the M. So that's a common misconception. But more importantly, what's the most important thing I would like people to know about it? I think that despite a lot of the stereotypes and misconceptions about kink and BDSM that are out there and are perpetuated by things like 50 Shades of Grey, whereas the protagonist Dom is only into kink because, spoiler alert, he experienced trauma and abuse, that kink can actually be a healthy and fulfilling way of expressing one's sexuality.
That's the key piece, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so your talk, Healing Through Kink, BDSM, Trauma, and Illness, you and Alex. Alex, welcome, by the way.
Thank you.
Can you hear us?
I can hear you perfectly fine. Can you hear me?
Yes. Awesome.
Awesome. I can hear you.
So I know that the two of you are doing this talk. And so maybe we can just dive into that a little bit because let me start generally. How can the practice of BDSM contribute to healing?
It can be a way to sort of flip the script on trauma by creating a safe container with a trusted partner where one can experience consensual pain, power dynamics, and sexuality on one's own terms rather than trauma. So much of that experience can involve, especially when it involves sexual or physical abuse, can be about the loss of control. Although kink may appear on the surface to look like giving up of control, it's actually more of a symbolic surrender of control where the submissive partner is ultimately calling the shots. So it's a way to kind of flip that script and regain some control about when what happens to you in your body and, you know, to have that say in your own experience.
And Alex, do you feel that it also activates a state of helplessness that one might have felt in childhood if there was trauma that was abusive? Does it sort of give you, in other words, both activate it and give you an opportunity to create a different narrative around what happened? Do you think that's true?
Certainly so. I think more than anything, BDSM and the practices that are encompassed within that are really a platform to be utilized in different ways. And so you might use BDSM as a platform for exploring many different things. But I think that what we see with trauma is a lot of people who experience trauma, where that's a really dynamic term that can refer to many things, are really bound to this sort of pain and are prone to like dissociation and all these things that come with trauma. And what BDSM offers, as Melody touches upon, is a space to renegotiate that, right? If you were involved in this traumatic experience where you feel like you lost a lot of power, then you might do a practice or a scene wherein you go to a very vulnerable place, and you're able to renegotiate the power that you lost on your own terms, right? Because when you're doing BDSM or you're doing a scene within BDSM, you get to pick who you're doing it with, what goes on, it stops when you say stop. Everything that you want to happen is happening in it. Even though on the surface it may seem, oh, the Dom has all the power and the sub has no power. Really, in a healthy BDSM framework, both sides have equal say about what goes on and what transpires. So it offers a really wonderful platform for you to kind of confront certain things and be vulnerable, but in a safe space and on a in a consensual space.
Mm-hmm. And Melody, you were talking about the misconception that a person's history is what you said. There were some statistics that you wanted to bring to the table around the correlation between a person's history and their experiences in BDSM, and that it actually is a myth to think that it's directly correlated with trauma.
Yeah, right? There were a number of recent research studies that showed that folks who practice BDSM were no more likely to have experienced childhood sexual or physical abuse or trauma than folks who didn't end up getting involved in BDSM. So the the narrative that people who are kinky are obviously reenacting some sort of sexual trauma, and that it's an unhealthy coping mechanism, isn't necessarily the case. And that's not to say that there aren't many folks involved in kink who have experienced trauma, whether sexual or otherwise, but it's not necessarily a strong correlation. I mean, unfortunately, trauma is super common, especially childhood right. trauma and mm-hmm. aversive experiences. Yeah. And so that's something that we should be mindful of, whether engaging in BDSM or, you know, any sort of sexual exploration. But it's interesting that this new research coming out has been showing that it's not a chicken and an egg sort of scenario.
Do you think there's an increased interest? Do you think it's growing? Do you think it is becoming more, I don't want to say mainstream, I'm not sure if that's the right term, but...
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely coming, becoming a bit more mainstream, and that just over the last 10 years, it's become so much more acceptable to even joke about it or talk about it. Things like FetLife, it's like a social media website that's basically Facebook for the kinky, and it went from about 10 years ago just starting up in Montreal with a few thousand users, and now it has over 7 million. So there's definitely been a proliferation of interest in kink in the last decade or so. Ththanks to the internet, I think, especially, has had a large effect on that. People finding out mm-hmm. that they're interests in kinky stuff aren't quite as necessarily as odd and unusual as they might have previously thought they were.
That was a great question, or a great answer, because I was going to ask you, why do you think it's changed so much in the past 10 years? Yeah. And so the internet is one. Is there anything else you think that is really paramount that's kind of created that catalyst?
I think 50 Shades of Grey was a big one. It's definitely mm-hmm. not the most accurate representation of kink. There's generally a more healthy power dynamic that should be strived for. Little bit less stalking and sexual assault, literally. And
I didn't personally see the movie because I heard exactly what you're
less coercion, so. More, you know, clear and healthy negotiation and consent, absolutely.
Right, and and knowing yourself and it, mm-hmm. it being balanced, so you're actually... whoever's involved knows what they want, as opposed to it being
someone who, you know, had barely been kissed before and is yeah. expected to right. dive, you know, headfirst into this intense, like, dom-sub relationship.
Right. And it's romanticized. I mean, he's yeah. so dreamy, you know. If he was some dork, if they cast some dork with warts on his nose or whatever, like someone creepy.
It would
creepy.
Be a Criminal Minds
yeah.
episode.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Right. Right. Alex, do you want to chime in there on your thoughts as to, is this becoming more relevant today?
I certainly think so. I think Melody brings up an excellent point about FetLife and the internet giving people access to things, where before, you know, if it was 1992 and you said, I really want to be smacked around and I want to dress up like a farmer and pretend to be a tractor or turn into a table, people might have said, like, oh, wow, that's really interesting there, you know, at best, and kind of shunned you at worst. And a lot of people have those stories of having to hide in secrecy and the shame that that cultivates. And fortunately, you know, the internet makes everything quite literally a click away. Everything mm-hmm. is at the tip of our fingertips. Mm-hmm. So if you just want to log on to FetLife or go on to Instagram and follow a kink page, anything you want is really quite mm-hmm. literally and metaphorically at the tips of your fingers. And so I think what kept people away was a lot of this gatekeeping, and there were a lot of barriers, and now the internet has really dissolved a lot of those mm-hmm. and people are able to find community. So if you live in a very remote location, it doesn't matter. You can access anything from anywhere in the world. You can find a group of like-minded and similar people who also want to be flogged or are into the same things you're into, and you can talk about that in platonic ways or also in kinky ways. So I think people are really able to build community through the internet, specifically around kink, in a way that did not exist before that platform, you know, was as popular as it is, mm-hmm. or as it's become.
And Shauna, we talked a little bit before the show about the DSM, which is the Diagnostic manual, which is used, I don't know, maybe you can define it first of all for our listeners, but also I want you to touch on this whole idea that a sexual proclivity would be found in a manual that diagnoses mental disorders and labels them as simply that, a disorder. Do you want to just touch on that? And
sure. So I think the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, there's been multiple editions. We're currently on DSM-5. And it has been a useful tool to help physicians and other areas that rely on it, including in legal ramifications and insurance reasons, to help provide a consistent understanding of what composes a mental disorder and what doesn't. And one of the main features that's tied between that is there has to be a component of distress either to oneself mm-hmm. or to someone else. And that classification system does help us diagnostically. However, it can come at the cost of having labels associated with it, which can definitely affect people's perceptions, both within themselves and externally, how the environment or the community experiences them. On the other hand, though, by having a diagnosable DSM diagnosis, you can actually access services and treatment because it's something that has been shown to be mm-hmm. a true entity in itself. I'm not sure if I'm answering that correctly, but there's two sides to it. There's good and bad, yeah.
Right, and it can be abused or it could be helpful.
Exactly. There can be stigma and shame associated with it, or it can open doors and help provide some access to treatment and mm-hmm. services.
But the key I'm hearing you say is there distress? It's not for someone else to label, someone other than you to label whether this is working for you or not.
Right.
So if it was actually working for you and working for whoever you're participating in whatever you're doing, then who really has the problem here? And what is the problem, right?
Exactly. I mean, there are certain places where you can imagine, for example, with pedophilia, mm-hmm. The individual that might be engaging in acts, they may not be experiencing any distress around
right.
it. But, of course, a child who cannot consent, mm-hmm. they, of course, are vulnerable and they're experiencing the distress. So that
right.
would definitely be included as part of the DSM-5.
Right, the ethical
yeah.
considerations and whether there's a power over dynamic or anything else, yeah?
Yeah.
May I pitch in?
Mm-hmm.
Please. I thought it was interesting to note that up until 2013, the most recent iteration of the DSM, the DSM-5, sexual sadism and sexual masochism were still classified as psychological disorders.
Right.
And so lumping them in with pedophilia and non-consensual exhibitionism and other paraphilias. And it's only in the latest version, the DSM-5, that distinguish between sadism and masochism as paraphilias, which are defined as non-normative sexual preferences but aren't inherently mental disorders, and paraphilic disorders, which can only be diagnosed, as Shauna said, if there's a lack of consent or if one's kink causes clinically significant distress or impairment.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, anyone who's read that book, or you don't really read it, but looked at that book, you will find yourself in it no matter whether you're kinky or not. It's like every single person I know, you look and you go, oh, I've got that, and I've got that, and I've got that. I mean, mostly people don't look for themselves. They look for whoever they're struggling with in their life and going, you're that. That's the problem. I knew it.
Well, and I think it's important because, like, our sexuality is so complex,
yeah.
you know, and
yeah.
we were talking just
and,
before
and
the show.
And often hold shame from childhood because our society
is evolving.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what we had Kayla on last year. And that's when, you know, the biggest holdback and setback is shame. And
mm-hmm.
I think people are becoming more and more
yeah.
in tune to their own sexuality and learning not to be ashamed from the social conditioning, religious mm-hmm. conditioning, you know, all the conditioning that's happened throughout our history and our culture. So I just think it's really important to be aware. That's why we find ourselves in those books, right?
And the role-playing, I think for me what's so astounding is, you know, when you think of the 50s and you think of how indoctrinated people were in the roles that you played. Like, it just was, this is what you did and this is what you didn't do. I mean, it was just such a program. Right. And I think all of that starting to shift brings a kind of fluidity everywhere in many areas, right, but in particular in sexuality.
Yeah. If I can chime in for a second, kind of elaborate on those points, I think that what really is happening is not just, you know, the presence of the internet, but the way that the internet has taken down those barriers of shame that you just mentioned, where people were in isolation and felt a lot of shame for not adhering to these really prescriptive ideas of sex and sexuality. I think community is a great remedy for shame. And so it's not just that you're able to go onto the internet and find a site like FetLife. It's that you're able to go onto a site like FetLife and find groups and find swathes of other people who are into the same things you are. And you see, wow, I'm not the only person who's into this.
Exactly.
Okay, so maybe I'm not weird or abnormal. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm not a freak, mm-hmm, or maybe I'm not deviant. And there's 500 other people in my area alone who are into this. There's we collectively refer to the area of D.C., Maryland, and Virginia as the DMV, where I'm from. And so if you say, oh, wow, in the DMV, there's 1,400 people who are all into spanking or who are all into whatever kink have you, you start to feel less shame because you see that it's not just you. So I think that being able to access community in these newfound ways is really what's being this barrier, tearing down that barrier of shame that people, mm-hmm, were, you know, went up against before. So
yeah, super
really
important
stuff.
Very important. Thank you, Alex. We're going to take a short break. We're going to play a little Canadian track of music. This is from Said the Whale on Conscious Living Radio 100.5 FM in Vancouver, Co-op Radio. And when we come back, we're going to touch on Keeping It Wet and Wonderful, a guide to sexual lubricants from a sex doctor.
Join me, Derek White, Sky Cloud. I am your host every Wednesday night from 5 to 6 p.m. for Métis Matters Radio, where we discuss why Métis matters and the worldwide matters of Métis people. From the past to the present, every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m. on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
You're listening to Conscious Living Radio 100.5 FM in Vancouver, Co-op Radio. I'm Tasha Sims.
And I'm Mark Cron.
And we're talking about sex tonight. I know you thought I was going to play Salt and Pepper, but I didn't. You know why? Because it was too predictable.
And we had a comment on our Facebook Live saying it was unusual, raw, and daring. So, great job.
Ooh. Good. Yeah, we're speaking about ConvergeCon 2019, which is a conference coming up. The dates, again, are March
30th and 31st.
Yeah, at Simon Fraser in downtown Vancouver. And such an incredible array of speakers and trainings and panels. And it really is for everyone. The goal here is to create a dialogue and introduce everyone to open conversation about many areas of around sexuality. Is there room for monogamy? Just asking.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We're not down on anyone's jam. We don't yuck anyone's yum.
Right. So there's no words like, oh, so vanilla. That's okay.
Fine.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm being half facetious, but not, because I actually have seen a reverse prejudice, actually.
Yeah.
Like as if you're uptight.
Yeah.
Oh, you're monogamous. You must be uptight.
Yeah, and we try not to foster that belief. I mean, whatever right. works for you, and we don't yuck anyone's yum unless it's illegal.
I like that. We don't yuck your yum. So speaking of yum, go ahead.
I keep hearing, be free to be yourself.
Yeah.
Right? Yep.
You know, and engage that, because there's a liberation and a freedom when we can actually be free, not be shameful around our sexuality.
Exactly.
And if monogamy works for you, great. If polyamory works for you, great. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Anyways.
And so to do that and be free, I want to move the conversation to our doctor here, because your talk is about lubricants. And I know you also work with people who have pain and who have dysfunction and things that they don't want to have. And certainly as a woman ages, this is one of the issues that needs to be addressed and needs to be talked about. Actually, when I saw it, I just went, oh, this is great. This is so exciting, because I other than being told, as you said, get some KY jelly, I don't know what else there is even to be said. So I'm really curious to hear what your focus will be in the talk.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. I also think that this is a super, super important area of people's general sense of quality of their life and who they are as individuals. And when things aren't working well, there can be a lot of shame and distress about that. And then most of the time, people kind of suffer in silence because they don't know how to bring it up. They don't know how to ask for help. Even talking to your doctor, who you can talk to about other very intimate, private details, there might be some difficulty and embarrassment and shame about talking about changes in your sexual functioning. And there's lots of studies out there that show that patients actually expect the physicians to actually bring up sexual functioning. And unfortunately, not yet. We're hoping to change that. We're working towards that. But we would like more healthcare providers to actually start and open that dialogue. But if you are a patient or a client, please feel free to bring it up. Mm-hmm. If you're struggling with it.
One small question I have. Yeah. Is there something there within the medical field where they're not to bring that up, or that's not something to ask or inquire about people's sexual health?
Like, how come?
Yeah,
it
how
isn't.
Come they don't? How, because it's a big part of who we are as a human being, right?
Yeah. I think there's just a lot of... emphasis in medical schools now to change this, and there's an awareness, especially at the foundational levels of medical school. But I think over time, unless you see other physicians that you're watching and that are supervising you, unless you see them do it, it might kind of slip off the radar. Our hope is that, the graduates from UBC are actually seeing more, that they are asking their patients more. They're seeing their supervisors ask patients and bring up the question, and that's our hope at UBC, so that at least in this medical school there's a different,
maybe a generational shift.
Yeah, I think that will also play a role. Yeah.
Do you think there's concern, let me see how to phrase this, I'm not sure it's inappropriateness, but do you think they're being careful to kind of safeguard? It's like a little taboo area. And so if I stay away from sex, I'm never going to be
sued
or you know, I've heard a lot of different stories. As simple as a GP who's doing a breast exam and actually undoing the woman's bra. Now, you could listen to that, and I know the intent was not negative, but, whoa, for that woman, that could have been really had repercussions. So if these things aren't being taught, and they're not as, their relationship to them isn't as open and comfortable, are they avoiding it because of that fear?
I think that has definitely played a role, and I think a way to undo that is by bringing the same consent conversation that we have in the bedroom into the office when you're working with patients. So you ask for consent. You know, first of all, you'd screen for, have you noticed any changes in your sexual functioning? And if the patient says yes, then you'd ask, would you feel comfortable with us exploring this in a bit more detail?
Right.
So I think that's an important piece.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so lubricants. What do we need to know about lubricants?
Great. Yes. So not all lubricants are equal. There are different types and classes of lubricants, and not all of them are benign. In other words, some of them actually create some damage to your very, very sensitive, fragile tissues. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. So when you're looking at what's available in pharmacies on the shelves, there needs to be a little bit more awareness of what the actual ingredients are so that you make smart, healthy decisions about what you're putting inside your body. One of the main things that the WHO, so the World Health Organization, has released, they've put out a position paper on what they recommend lubricants consist of in terms of the ingredients that minimize the what we call osmolality of the substances. And unfortunately, most products on the market do not meet the recommended guidelines.
So you're looking for natural, you're looking with, would you be able to pronounce all the ingredients? Is that kind of...
Yes and no. It depends on the class that you're looking at. So if you're looking at water-based lubricants, there are lots of ingredients that need to be added that are still, quote-unquote, natural ingredients, but you may not be able to pronounce the names on them.
Okay.
But the water-based lubricants are the ones that are most likely to have high osmolality. They're also the ones that are most likely to have parabens added and glycerins, which also can be irritating to tissues. Mm-hmm. So my recommendation, if you're going to go with a water-based lubricant, that you consider paraben-free, glycerin-free, and you find out what the osmolality is and make sure that it's around the 300 range.
So who are you asking? Pharmacist?
No, you're going to have to do some Googling yourself.
This Dr. information, Google!
This information
Uncle
is
Google.
Not
so it's not
easy
like it's
to
there
find.
On the package.
No, they're very sneaky about that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you go into the oil-based lubricants or the silicone-based lubricants, they tend to have less of the irritating components. A little caveat about oil-based lubricants is that they're not compatible with latex condoms. So you would have to consider using a non-latex condom to use an oil-based lubricant.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any kind of guidance for listeners out there who maybe are... Well, let's just talk for a second about pain, experiencing some sort of painful situation, and how would you guide them? What would you say?
First, I would say that it is very, very common. So up to 15% of women experience pain with penetrative sexual activity. That is a lot of women out there. And most of these women are suffering in silence and not knowing how to get access and support around this. The sort of the DSM-5 diagnosis is something called genital pelvic pain / penetration disorder, or GPPPD. It's a mouthful. But you can kind of break it down into two main conditions. One is called vaginismus, and one is called provoked vestibulodynia. Both of these are things that are conditions that we are able to help support people get better, to improve, to have less distress around, and ultimately we want to improve their sexual functioning and have them experience more sexual pleasure, which I think we are able to do, but it's not a quick, easy thing.
What is it treated with? How would you treat it?
So at our clinic, one of the mainstays is providing a lot of psychoeducation, a lot of recommendations about how to increase sexual arousal, because arousal in itself is analgesic. Mm-hmm. And we also are strong proponents, and I've done a lot of research on the use of mindfulness as a attention regulating skill that allows for decreasing of the distress around chronic pain syndromes, including pain syndromes related to penetrative activities.
And more awareness as a transpersonal psychotherapist, more body awareness of what is actually going on in the now.
Right.
I mean, it amazes me how people go from A to B to C and are not present. How can you engage in a meaningful, authentic way, whatever way you choose to do it, if you're not tuned in to what's going on in the body and with it, and learning to express it and articulate and include whoever you're having sex with, right?
Right.
And on that note, I want to say, as a man, Tasha, I think it's important for the men out there who are listening is to really pay attention to your partner, you know, to see if they are in pain, see if they are uncomfortable, because sometimes they won't say anything.
Right. Yep.
And to really take the lead in that sense, especially if you need to, because it's uncomfortable for us men too.
Yeah. Right. Everybody wants that their partner or somebody that they're engaging with to be an active participant, where you're invested in optimizing your sexual pleasure. That's what we all want. And so it is important that you kind of speak up.
Yeah, communication is key. Sure.
And I've always said, if you don't know, there are always two realities. If you're in an interaction with a human being,
absolutely,
there are at least two realities.
Absolutely.
And if you don't know yours and theirs, there's a missing piece, right? There's a disconnect.
Yeah. And just speaking about men, so at our clinic, we run treatment groups for women with a variety of different sexual dysfunctions or concerns. We also run treatment groups, mindfulness-based treatment groups for men with certain sexual dysfunctions and concerns.
Right. And we're going to give information on how to find everybody's contact info near the end of the show. Well, we've only got about 10 minutes. What else is important to cover here? Actually, Alex, can we move to you?
Certainly.
You've got some pretty fascinating talks coming up at ConvergeCon. Can we start with From Cuckold to Race Play, the implications of fetishizing race? Can you tell us what those implications are and what you mean by that?
Oh, wow. Yes. To dive into that, so that session or workshop was born a couple of years ago. And I have presented it before at CatalystCon, which we spoke about earlier on in the evening. And I would watch porn, as many red-blooded humans do. And I noticed that whenever I would go to a site, it would categorize things typically by acts that transpired within the pornography. So you might see blowjob porn. I don't know if I can say that, excuse me.
You can say anything you want.
Wonderful. But you might see blowjob porn, or you might see spanking porn. And if you fancy that you want to see a blowjob, you would go look up that porn. But then you would also see things that describe the people within the porn. And very quickly you notice that there's not a lot of overlap between that. So what I mean is, you could go see blowjob porn and you would expect that the people in that porn would be white people. And then you could look up ebony blowjob porn, and in that porn you would see black people. And ebony is a term that specifically refers to black women giving blowjobs. But if you go and you just search by the act, you will not see black people in that, or people who deviate from whiteness, or people of color, I guess, is a better way to articulate it. And so I noticed, huh, that's really strange. And I would start to see submissive Asian teen or fiery Latina. But every time there was a piece of porn or a pornographic film that featured a non-white person, it was explicitly mentioned in the title of the pornography. It was never just a minor detail. It was always a focal point. And I thought that was really strange. And I started to notice how porn kind of replicated racist ideologies that exist within society. And if you look at things like BBC or Cuckold, which are mentioned in the title, they take on very heavily racial connotation. So to cuckold someone, the definition is just, if me and another person are in a relationship and I cheat on them, I've made them into a cuckold, right? So there's no inherent racial component. And yet, if you are to search cuckold porn, it's very, very, very heavily racialized. And you see this recurring theme of white wives being blacked as a common term. And there's a lot of very racist ideology that come in tandem with that. And so I thought to myself, you know, how can we divorce this sort of animalistic dehumanization of black men and black bodies from other animalistic dehumanization? If we recall the Mike Brown case, where Mike Brown was killed by Officer Darren Wilson, Darren Wilson goes on to describe Mike Brown as a beast, as an animal. So how can we divorce that kind of animalistic dehumanization that's leading to direct harm against black people and leading to the death of black people from a piece of pornography in which someone is saying, oh, wow, this stud-like mandingo breeds my wife, which is a lot of very charged, animalistically dehumanizing language. And so I wanted to explore that, and I think that the implications, unfortunately, of this really racially charged pornography are numerous, and I don't want the takeaway to be that having people of color in porn is bad. Certainly, I don't agree with that, but I think that the
stereotypes.
The stereotypes, thank you very much, exactly, are very complicit in a lot of harm that happens to black people in and out of the bedroom. And I think my desire within sex education for a very long time, even before I crafted this workshop, was just to ask about the limits of sex positivity. I think as we've ushered into this age of claiming sex positivity, which has been very great for many people, I wonder, where's the wall, so to speak? We can say it's great to be sex positive. We can say, you know, it's great to pursue fantasies as long as they're safe, sane, and consensual. But at a certain point, if someone is saying or sharing a fantasy that's directly predicated on racist ideologies or sexist ideologies, is there a point at which we can say, hey, actually, I think that's kind of bad. I think that that's replicating harm. I think that's replicating white supremacist concepts of blackness. How do we push back on that, and how do we interact with that, and what do we do after we realize that?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's going to be an interesting talk. I wonder if we could shift a bit towards this whole concept of identifying, because that's certainly on, you know, the current horizon. And I wonder, you know, I want to bring in spirituality here for a minute. This is called Conscious Living Radio, after all.
And there is sacred sexuality, of course.
And there is sacred sexuality, which we didn't dive into here. But part of, and I'll speak about myself, part of my growth has been to dissolve identification. So when I think of spirituality, I don't label myself even as human. Forget about a sexual orientation. So I'm just curious what your take on that is, because it seems to be really important to a lot of people. So I wonder, just what's your take, and wide open to all of you. It's not exactly a question. It's more of a, you know, here's the umbrella. Let's talk about it. Why is it occurring, and is it important, and how does that map over to? Because the concept of spirituality is oneness and dissolving polarity in a way, so that you're in touch with an essence, an energetic essence that is not identified as ego or human.
I'm happy to jump in. My experience and my growth in terms of my own sexuality is within the sacred sexuality umbrella. And it's recognizing the power of our sexuality for creation. It creates all life. It's sacred, it's divine, and when you can connect in a level of oneness throughout your sexuality, that has taken me to some places of a spiritual level and a, you know, cosmic, without sounding kind of crazy. But I've had some really, really transformative experiences through an honoring, and through tantra, and practicing and respecting and honoring and recognizing the divine feminine.
Do you identify as a heterosexual?
Pretty much.
Okay, so this is what I want to bring to the table.
I think there's a little bit of labels that don't include gender versus orientation here. I don't know which one you're speaking to specifically, but I feel like gender is in its own. You own that. That's your own identity as far as your orientation, who you're sexually attracted to. That's also your own. So those are two different things.
Well, honestly, right? in a spiritual perspective, mm-hmm. I believe I have masculine, I have feminine.
Yes.
It's an energy.
Yes.
It's not actually an identification sure. as a man or a woman. Even,
yeah.
You know.
I think the two-spirited people, folks would agree with that for mm-hmm. sure. And that's yeah. a MAT, and I identified mm-hmm. that a long
right,
time ago.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. yeah, I get where you're going with spirituality, but... I'm not really
right.
sure.
Let's touch on what's happening.
Labels are...
Yeah, labels, identity.
And returning to labels, I think I'm touching on the proliferation of labels that weren't commonly used being more and more commonly adopted, especially in younger generations. I think it's part of it is experiencing a sense of belonging when, kind of like when someone discovers kink on the internet, as we were talking about earlier,
right.
as in, I'm not the only one who feels, you know, for yeah. example, like I'm not a boy or a girl, or mm-hmm. I am attracted to more than one gender, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it might also have to do with the internet, like I was discussing earlier, in that people are claiming these identities and other people are finding that that resonates for them as well.
And I think we're going to keep developing more and more identities as people
yeah.
push and expand their sense of their identity. They're going to have new labels and the language is just going to keep
yeah.
developing,
mm-hmm.
Which I think is really fascinating.
It's almost like something in the development of this new language is... on the road to freedom, right? It is, if it's under that umbrella. Therefore, at some point, it becomes non-identification, because that's what, to me, right. anyway, ultimate freedom is.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's certainly a matter of access. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's certainly a matter of access, as people have more and more access to things.
Mm-hmm.
And that not only includes the internet, but also just people having access to social spaces where they can discuss these things and are not so taboo. But also, I think that while we're developing new terms, they're also not new concepts. I think people exploring and deviating from binaries is very, very old. And so a lot of my work focuses on liberation and decolonization. And these processes or these concepts have existed forever, for a very, very long time. And people accessing these things and developing new language to some very, very old concepts.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've just got time for you all to share how our listeners can find out more about you if you want to chime in with your websites. We will have this show and all the information and links to Converge 2019 on consciouslivingradio.org.
It's already there.
It's already there. But go ahead. Let's do a go around the table. And how can they find out more about you? Let's start with you, Shauna.
So people can find out more about our clinic. It's the BC Center for Sexual Medicine, located at the Vancouver General Hospital. Just if you Google BC Center for Sexual Medicine, you'll be able to find a link to our page.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. Melanie?
This is Melody Ann. Yeah. Best place to find me would be on social media. So my Twitter handle is at Erotic Educator. My Instagram's also Erotic Educator. And you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/Erotic Educator.
And Alex?
So I'm most active on Twitter, if you want to find me there, and that kind of has access to most of the other social media platforms I'm available on. And my at name on Twitter is at Lex About Sex, so that's L-E-X underscore about underscore sex. And on Instagram, I am Lex Talk About Sex, kind of a play on, you know, Let's Talk About Sex. And it's Lex underscore talk underscore about underscore sex.
Awesome. And Wendy?
ConvergeCon.ca is our conference, and just when we went live, we actually launched the sale of one-day tickets for ConvergeCon. So you can go to contact us at ConvergeCon.ca and click on the register link. So if you just want a taste, it's one-day sales. Tickets started
Beautiful.
Today. So,
and that's March 30th and 31st in downtown Vancouver. Thank you all so much. It's been a fascinating conversation, a real pleasure to have you all here, and you, Alex, calling in from the States. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Conscious Living Radio 100.5 FM in Vancouver, Co-op Radio. We're going to leave you with a track, another Canadian track. This guy's called Patrick Watson, and the track is Melody. That's okay. Mark was tired of me talking. He just decided to cut my mic. It was like, enough already. Are you ready, Mark?
Yes.
Melody Noir, Patrick Watson on Co-op Radio. Good night. See you next week.
Tell me where the wind is blowing, 'cause that's where the music's going. You want my big dark blue and I wanna swim all around you. You are the sweetest melody I've ever sung. I feel like I know you, but you're just a ghost to me. And when I sit beside your shadow, somehow it comforts me. You are the sweetest melody I've ever sung. The sweetest melody I've never sung. Of your touch that fits in your arms as much, and when I try to fill it up, the hole gets bigger every time. You are the sweetest melody I've